Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Green Room. We are not talking about AI today. Actually, we might. We'll find out. We're going to do some quick introductions, but I'm here with my amazing co-host, Bala Ashar, our producer, Elle, and of course, our guests. We have four guests today. We'll start with Chris. Chris, where are you coming in from? What are we talking about today?
From San Jose, California, Gilroy specifically, and talking about how we can be brave together.
All right. Great new book out there. Kian and Jeremy. Kian, where are you coming in from? What are we talking about today?
I'm in LA today.
All right. And what are we going to talk about?
Well, Jeremy and I are going to talk about our latest research on human AI collaboration.
Very, very cool. Jeremy, where are you coming in from? I think you're like across the street from me somewhere.
I'm close. I'm in La Honda up in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And I'm excited to be here second time, actually. I'm a second timer. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and you were a keynote speaker at CCE. So
yeah, I was at Sam's last night, and I thought of CCE very fondly. So I just want you guys to know.
That's awesome.
I think of it fondly all the time. It's my favorite one of the year.
Yeah,
Grant, where are you coming in from? Probably somewhere shabby. I don't know where.
I'm in Sonoma, north of San Francisco today, wine country, and we're going to be talking about scaling software as a service companies and artificial intelligence for finance folks. So. Very excited.
Very, very cool. We are in the age of AI, and we'll hear more. All right, back to you, Elle, for the count.
All right, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome. Thank you for joining us on Disrupt TV. My name is Bala Ashar. I'm the Chief Digital Evangelist at Salesforce and your co-host for the next hour. We welcome you to follow us on X at Disrupt TV Show. Send your questions to Ray, myself, and our distinguished guests, and we'll do our best to answer them in the next hour. It's my pleasure to introduce my co-host, Ray Wong. He's the CEO and founder of Constellation Research. He's the best-selling author of Everybody Wants to Rule the World. He's on TV every day. I see him on Bloomberg, Yahoo Finance, CNBC, Fox Business. In my opinion, he's one of the top futurists to follow on X at RWA and G0. Welcome, Ray Wong, to Disrupt TV.
Hey, thanks a lot. I'm here with my amazing co-host, Bala Ashar, the Chief Digital Evangelist for Salesforce. He's also the author of multiple books, including Boundless, A New Mindset for Unlimited Business Success, and a number one seller on Amazon. But executives around the world pay attention to every one of his inspirational and insightful tweets. And when he's not speaking or keynoting at events for Salesforce, he's actually writing some insightful analysis on ZDNet. And of course, you can find him on TV outlets like Bloomberg. So, but it's not about us. It's about our amazing guests. And of course, who do we have to bring back again?
We have a first ballot Hall of Fame Disrupt inductee coming back because we love speaking to super smart CEOs. Grant Halloran is the Chief Executive Officer at Planful. Planful is the pioneer of end-to-end financial close, consolidation, and financial planning and analysis cloud software. Grant has over 25 years of experience as a software executive, co-founding 3 SaaS businesses and holding leadership positions in companies that raised over $500 million of capital and created over $11 billion of enterprise value. You can follow Grant on both X and LinkedIn at Grant Halloran. Welcome back, Grant, to Disrupt TV.
Thanks so much. Awesome to be here, Bala and Ray. This is the first time I've been on with that really cool professional intro. Some pretty marquee people up there. So I'm humbled to have a chance to chat with you guys.
Thank you.
Hey, no problem. We always come to you for insightful ideas, what's happening. You're sitting at the intersection between where startups are, where SaaS companies are headed, and more importantly, where AI now and finance are moving. Scaling a SaaS company is not easy, right? People make it look easy. We know there's a lot of sausage making in the background. Let's start there because we've talked to you about almost every other topic except for, hey, what do you do to scale up a SaaS company? And that's why we wanted to start there and share some of your insights and leadership principles.
Yeah, I'm very happy to. Well, I think we could probably spend 10 or 20 hours on this topic.
I'm sure your board does too. But
Vala probably has a million stories from the Salesforce history. But I want to zero in on one particular topic today, and that is that when you're scaling, and I'm really talking about companies that have probably reached that 50 million revenue mark, and before that, you know everybody, you can get by without a lot of formality in your processes and you tend to be pretty quick. But once you get around 50 million, you're off to the races and you're scaling that company and you're trying to get out to hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue and then beyond that. So you're in that scaling zone. What tends to happen at that point is things like committees start developing and standard operating procedures, SOPs start getting created and policy mandates. And, the audience is probably listening to those words and cringing a little bit because they're very, they're very bureaucratic sounding. Okay. And they are, they can tend to end up being bureaucratic. So let's firstly start with why do those things emerge? They emerge because, and this is what I talk a lot about in my company, Planful, is the natural force of entropy, right? Now, I'm not talking about thermodynamics, entropy, second law of thermodynamics. I'm talking about any complex system will tend over time towards chaos. It's this entropic force that happens, right? So when companies start to implement, management starts to implement these bureaucratic sounding things, they're doing so from good intention. They're saying like, hey, we got new folks coming in. They don't know how this is going to work. We need to make this standardized and repeatable. So it's starting from very good intention. You start to implement those things. Professional management comes in and, for a period of time, things start to work. This counterforce to entropy starts to feel good, right? There's less chaos. People feel good. Then the worst part starts to happen. When the really bad stuff happens. You get what's called busy work. You get made up jobs in companies, right? Look at Twitter. It's half the people there were like, well, what were these jobs doing? So came along. You start to get little fiefdoms and politics develop. Decision velocity, your favorite subject, right? It declines very dramatically and quickly. And then the worst thing that happens, and you'll often ask people, what was it like working in a certain company? And they'll say, I couldn't get a decision made. Right, so all of this stuff that happens. So this bureaucratic counterforce, goes so far as what Jeff Bezos calls stasis, the inevitable decline of companies down to their inevitable death. Okay, so it's pretty bad. It can get really bad. So what I want to suggest to people is that there is one thing that I believe pretty strongly is the counterforce to entropy and bureaucracy, right? And that is having a culture of why. And what this concept is, and we've enshrined this actually in our core values at our company, is around intention. And this is not only just about the permission to ask why are we doing something, why have we always done something this way. It's an expectation that throughout the whole company, you can walk into any meeting and say, why are we doing this? Why do we do it that way? Why are we doing this project? Why are we building that product? And if you can't get absolute clarity and consistency in answers, and it's precise and quantifiable, then it's not a very good why. Okay. Now, you're both very experienced guys. You've been running companies and in management positions for a long time. How many times have you walked into a project that's 3 or 6 months down, since its inception, and you'll walk in and you'll sit around the room and you've kind of forgotten like what this thing is all about, but there's lots of people involved. you throw out the worst question that an executive can ask at that point, which is, hey guys, remind me why we're doing this. And what happens, you get a lot of awkward body language, you get, you know, sort of looking at each other and so on and so forth. And you know, that's just a sort of nice little illustration of what I'm talking about. So how do you make this real? Well, one, you know, at least, you know, and I say this humbly, right? I don't have all the answers, but at least I find this works, is we enshrine that intention as one of our five core values in our company. And we teach our teams to think about it fairly methodically. Right. So anyone's allowed to ask and expected to ask why. If you're not clear about why we're doing something, you stop the meeting and you say, guys, we're gonna pull up the why reason again. That's the first part of it. The second is think about your why in terms of three categories, and sometimes these overlap. But generally, your why is gonna start with, we have a problem today that we need to solve. Two, we have a problem that we foresee, and this is what good managers and leaders do, is that they have judgment and experience and say, we foresee a problem emerging here that we need to get ahead of. Or three, you have a big opportunity, right? We're going to build this new product that no one else is doing, and we think it's going to be huge. And sometimes it can be a combination of those things. The second is quantify that, right? So we ask for a very pithy one paragraph problem statement. We then look for very detailed math and financial implications of that. It can be all sorts of metrics. And then finally, it's really about then comparing that. So once we've quantified it, it's comparing that to other things that have a why. And look, it works for us in the sense that we've had profound changes to things that were on a certain course, where we've stopped and said, why are we doing this? And there was new people involved and they didn't really understand it. And it catalyzed a whole different conversation. And it actually meant we just completely stopped doing that work, which may have resulted in hiring like 25 new people. And, you know, we're a 500 person company growing, you know, out to 1,000. So 25 people is impactful for us, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So anyway, let me pause there. That's just some thoughts I wanted to share with your audience about one little thing.
I think it's probably
I love it. And it's one little thing with profound impact. I take away from it that, you know, you're leading with humility, which you have a beginner's mindset, which means that you're questioning things. You're challenging assumptions, starting with your own. You have a safe space for that to happen.
Yes.
I've worked in places where if somebody asked a why, it could have been a career limiting question. Especially if lots of energy and expenses had gone into said project. So to have a safe space, and that starts from the top, you know, people are not afraid of failure. They're afraid of blame. So you need that CEO backing in order to have the courage to ask. Exactly. And I just listened to the CEO of the third most valuable company on earth. And Jensen said he doesn't have one-on-one meetings.
Yeah. I love
he has
that,
meetings with all his direct reports. That's I had not really heard about at that level someone who probably has 8 to 10 direct reports not having one-on-one meeting. And he explained, like, look, if we're going to practice radical transparency, I don't want to have a conversation in a silo with one of my direct reports and not have all the other direct reports benefit from the wisdom, the discussions, the questioning of the why that might happen. So anyway, it was stunning for me. It was a revelation. I hadn't heard that, and now I know two CEOs.
One-on-ones become these unstoppable time wasters in companies. If you cascade it through all the management layers in a company, and everyone's having all these one-on-ones and they have it doing 10, 15 hours a week of one-on-ones, and they just keep going through the same stuff. So this is what I call busy work.
Yeah.
Right. There's just it lacks intention. It lacks, you know, precision around what exactly. So, you know, I think Jensen nailed it when he said, look, these are super accomplished people. Like, I don't need to sit with them and, you know, every week and ask us. Like, we're interacting daily.
Yeah. Right.
We're interacting daily. They're messaging me, they're calling me, like, hey, what do you think of this? And, you know, that's the way it should be. And then, of course, once a month, you know, I'd have lunch or dinner with an executive and catch up on what's going on. But it's a lot of it is just these, you know, breaking down like what really works and sort of demystifying these things and trying to stay true to sort of like the innovation and disruption mindset that that you need to have in our technology industry. And it's hard to do as you scale. So here's just one idea of how you can
Now let's continue with that innovation and disruption in and stay with the theme of scaling. Your thoughts on AI helping, hurting, or having no impact on scaling a business, and specifically its impact on the financial industry?
Yeah, it's massive. I'm sorry to pile on all over the hype here, but we've been around this game for a while, guys, and often what I'll tell folks is the hype cycle in technology is very real, and we've seen it before. This one, it feels different. I think that it deserves all the hype, and it's you're going to take longer. It always takes longer than people think, right? There's a lot of it's a bell curve of capabilities in terms of adopting these technologies. So specifically as it pertains to, I'll start with finance professionals, Planful, as you mentioned earlier, right? We run the end-to-end financial performance management process. It's very complicated, from companies that, even pre-revenue bioscience companies all the way up to $50 billion companies, right? So a lot of complexity. It's massive for finance and accounting professionals for a couple of reasons. In our system, we have multi-dimensional, very complex multi-dimensional data sets and lots of data sets, operational data sets coming in from, Shopify and also, Toast and trying to get all sorts of analytics and stuff, CRM systems like Salesforce, so on. So finance systems, tons of ERPs, like very complex data. And up until now, like these systems are brilliant numerically. That's our core competency is we do financial data. And it's sometimes different operational data. And now what we're bringing in is the alpha. So we're creating an alphanumerical system. So if I focus just on language models and the extensive capabilities they're going to bring, the alpha aspects of running finance hitherto had to happen outside of the system. We're just really good at crunching all the numbers and getting the numbers in the right form at the right time for people. But telling a story around that data or creating an explanation or a narrative that involves language, and finance folks have had to do that. So we can definitely augment that now. That's what we're working on. I love it for finance for two reasons, and I'm being a little selfish as a CEO here, is it's really hard to do. And I love doing really hard things because it acts as a market differentiator, a further differentiator from competition. So the hardest things to do are the things that I get super attracted to. And it's really hard for a couple of reasons. One, most of the insight, when you're looking at a financial statement, most of the insight is there are millions of intersectional numbers that go make up those calculated values. So most of the insight's actually way below the sort of surface level of the spreadsheet that you might end up with. So that's going to be really hard to get inference and judgment from AI around. Secondly, you have to be 100% accurate. Yeah. If you're writing SQL code, you can be 90% accurate, right? And you can have someone then QA that SQL code using an LLM. In our case, we have to be 100% accurate. This is why it'll take a little bit longer, because even though the capabilities will come out, the trust to get the market en masse to trust it, people can go to jail if they get their financial numbers wrong. So it's a big challenge and exciting one.
Ray,
I was going to say, Grant, we definitely see that. And I think one of the big things is really that, with generative AI, 1+1 doesn't always equal 3. And so, in a probabilistic model, that's an issue, right? But in a deterministic world, right, as you're doing planning, you're going to use a different set of AI approaches that we often see that come out there. So knowing that, right, I mean, are customers ready for AI? And we probably only about 30 seconds, but do you think, thumbs down, do you think they're ready now? Are they ready in 12 months or are they ready in 2 years?
They're ready now, but we need to show them what it can do and show it to them in a way that they will trust. Okay. So we're going to keep the human in the loop, and we're going to execute this in a way that they can't get in trouble with it. Therein lies the art. So this is fun. This is fun stuff.
Very, very much so. We're here with Grant Holleran, CEO of Planful. You can follow him on X at Grant Holleran. And we've been talking about some leadership principles, which are really important in terms of scaling a SaaS company. And of course, a little bit about AI, of course. So thanks for being on the show, and happy Friday, Grant.
Great to see you, Grant. Thank you.
Cheers. Ciao. Thank you for coming back. Definite first ballot Hall of Fame. I really enjoyed his shared wisdom. Speaking of shared wisdom, we have a guest who's back on Disrupt. In fact, his book was named Disrupt 2023 Top Book. We have Jeremy Otley, author of Idea Flow, and Kian Goar, founder and CEO of Geolab. Jeremy is an adjunct professor at Stanford University, co-author of Idea Flow, the only business metric that matters, the Thinker's 50 top innovation leader, a general partner at Freespin Capital. He's host of several podcasts, including Beyond and Prompt. Jeremy has had the privilege of teaching nearly a million students, Ray, worldwide. In fact, he's earned multiple times favorite professor distinction, which I bet is his favorite award.
Many Stanford students. Yeah. I've heard that.
I bet that's his favorite award. His blend of deep expertise, sharp thinking, and penetrating insights have earned him reputation of a go-to advisor to CEOs of startups and large enterprise. His current research passion is helping individuals and organizations accelerate their comfort, as Grant was speaking, and confidence with generative AI. You can follow Jeremy at Jeremy Otley. Welcome back, Jeremy, to Disrupt TV.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
And congrats on your 2023 top book. My mom only buys book if it's Disrupt TV recommended. So you are.
You got to tell her I'm ready for her feedback. I'm ready for her hard-hitting questions. Let's go.
Yeah, be careful. She's got very opinionated. Kian Goar is founder and CEO of Geolab. Kian is Wall Street Journal best-selling author. We only have best-selling authors come on the show, competing in a new world of work. He's a keynote speaker. He's a futurist. He inspires organizations to build exponential teams to thrive in a world of hybrid work. Kian's a founder of Geolab, an innovation research and leadership development firm focused on coaching, strategy, and design. He's a former executive director at XPRIZE Foundation and Singularity University. Kian coached leadership teams of dozens of Fortune 500 companies, unicorns, and startups on disruptive innovation and exponential technologies. He's been featured, like you, Ray, he's featured all around the globe, major media, speaks at World Economic Forum and South by Southwest. He's an incredible thought leader. You can follow him on Twitter at FromTheKGB. That's pretty awesome. Welcome, Kian, to Disrupt TV.
Thanks so much, Vella and Ray. It's great to be here with you guys.
This is a top secret briefing. So I'm sitting here looking at HBR and I'm looking at the study and I'm talking like AI fluency. And I'm like, this is great. I mean, what is going on? Do you speak fluent AI? And I'm thinking like, okay, who came up with this? And of course it was you too. So talk a little bit about this study. It's definitely an HBR and people are definitely talking about it too. And some of the insights. So let's start there. So Kian.
Yeah. So, our work involves training teams to solve complex problems through collaboration and innovation. And when ChatGPT became publicly available in November of 22, we saw AI as a new toolkit for teams to use, but we just didn't know how effective it was going to be. So Jeremy and I created this research study and we worked with real teams having real business problems all across the world and designed the study to try to figure out how can generative AI support ideation and problem solving. And we basically gave half the folks in the study access to generative AI, and then the other half of the folks in the study no access to generative AI. So basically they just had to brainstorm and ideate with their brains. And crazy idea, right? Human thinking. And we were really interested in measuring two things. The number of ideas that teams came up with, did it differ between those who had AI and didn't have AI, and also the quality of ideas. And let me turn it over to Jeremy to kind of share what we learned, because we had some really contrarian and unexpected learnings.
Well, I would put it to Ray and Vala as well. I mean, what's your expectation, right? If the question is, do teams that have AI assistance generate more ideas? What do you say?
I would think it would be true. We would assume that this would be better.
And do they not just more, but better? The first question was more. The second question is, what's the variation? Higher variation, lower variation? What do you think?
I would think it'd be lower variation, more consistent, and more insightful.
My guess is both Ray and I would be dead wrong.
Yes, I know.
We were too. I mean, Vala, your humility is, we were as well. I mean, both Kian and I think we set out on this study thinking we were studying how much better are AI-assisted teams? That was kind of the subtext of the study. And as the results started pouring in, even from the first, you know, we studied many teams in both the US and in Europe. And as the results started pouring in, we started thinking, wait, oh no, this surely there's something wrong with the data. And then it was almost quickly,
Sample error.
Because what we found was AI-assisted teams actually didn't outperform their unassisted counterparts. And furthermore, often they actually underperformed, meaning they had less ideas and they had less good ideas. And so we started digging into why that is. And it won't surprise you to discover, you know, because I'm a super nerd, there's a cognitive bias at play, not a technology problem, but actually a human cognitive bias at play that's both predictable and preventable. But when it's left unchecked, rather than kind of unleashing human teams, AI actually amplifies their human cognitive bias.
This is a must-read article for all business leaders. It's titled, Don't Let Gen AI Limit Your Team's Creativity. It's, you know, you're talking 60 employees in multiple companies on each side of the pond. You know, Keon said generative AI helped workers avoid awful ideas, but it also led to more average ideas. And the one thing that I found interesting in the research was that the folks that were using generative AI were highly confident in their work. In fact, by a factor of 21% difference in terms of confidence. But when the grades came out in terms of are these good ideas or ideas we're going to punt, if the grades showed that that much of that confidence was misplaced. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't surprise me. Like, I would think that if I was using this advanced magical tools that we've been all enamored with for 2 years, I would assume that it's just natural tendency for me to feel good that I'm using the latest and greatest technology.
Vala, we have to stop. That's the point. That's the problem, right? The expectation of magic is the problem, right? And teams that go to generative AI, a collaboration with Gen AI, expecting magic, you know, it's amazing. They get it. And they don't find out till much later, right? We aren't grading the ideas in the moment. We're only grading them later. And it turns out they ended up settling for the most average ideas, right? The teams that actually wanted really great ideas, it turns out they collaborated with AI differently. So you could kind of characterize the desire for magic to approaching AI like an oracle. It's got the answer. We've just got to ask and it gives it to us, right? That felt magical and resulted in underperformance. As we studied the overperformers, what we found is they didn't treat AI like an oracle, and it didn't feel like magic, actually. They treated AI as a thought partner, and it actually wasn't enjoyable. It felt like work. And so we realized when you want it to feel like magic, it will, but it's not magical. If you want it to feel like work, it will, but it will be magical work.
Yeah, that's that great distinction. And the article is very long form. You have seven recommendations. One of them, the second to last, I think, is approach AI as an ongoing conversation partner, not an oracle. Mm-hmm. And then you end with a recommendation that says have someone from the outside of the team facilitate the final decision. Someone who doesn't have a dog in a race. I don't know if that was the exact language you used. But I love the fact that you promoted precision, iterative model. And again, don't treat this like some sort of magic wand that's going to help you get to the best solution. Highly recommend this. Can people learn more about the experiment beyond just?
Yeah, definitely. So
HBR.
Yeah, definitely. We have a website that has all of our best practices on how to develop team skills on using generative AI for problem solving. It also has, as part of research, we developed this AI drill coach that trains people on how to develop conversational AI skills and scale it across the organization. And in our early results, we're seeing teams 10x their team's AI skills using this drill coach. So all of this is available on our website, howtofixit.ai. Fix it is spelled fixit.ai. So check it out. There's a reason it's called Fix It, because we're problem solving with AI and with human brain. So all this is available on howtofixit.ai.
precise prompting. Very, very good. I mean, I think that's part of the best practice is really getting down specific, being drilling down onto the questions. And I thought that was actually pretty smart as well, because you have to train that AI. When you talk about these best practices as well, are there cultural things that actually have to change when you form those teams that would be different? I know you chose two teams, like they're different teams, two companies from Europe, two companies from the US, right? 60 people each. Were there different composition in teams or anything that you noticed in the team composition that would change these kind of outcomes or improve those outcomes?
This actually blew our mind. We had lots of innovation folks on some of these teams. And as you can imagine, the innovation folks are, they think they're experts and they know how to use all these tools and disruption. They actually struggled more and they had more underwhelming results than people who were non from innovation teams and came to it with a fresh set of eyes, just along the lines of what Grant was saying earlier about questioning things with why. We actually found that when you have a team that is constituted people of both innovation background and non-innovation background, you get a greater diversity of interactions and conversations that lead you to better answers than if you are all focused as experts in one particular space.
Wow, that is fascinating. You've democratized innovation. You take the innovation folks out and you've democratized innovation so that everyone can participate.
Well, and Ray, one thing that we're seeing is, you know, I think right now we're still at the stage where AI is considered tech and tech people are the ones who kind of naturally gravitate towards it. Coders gravitate towards it because it's in text and it's actually pretty good at parsing and things like that. But the truth is coders aren't the best users of generative AI. It turns out people who can talk to people are the best users of generative AI. And so there's kind of a renaissance of, call it liberal arts thinking and ways of acting and interacting. So if you're only having technology people, we would say you aren't bringing the right skill set to the table for collaboration with generative AI, because what it takes is a conversational ability. Think about managing someone. You know, what we saw these teams who treat AI like an oracle do is they give it a prompt and then they get an answer and they go, that's pretty good. Let's just go with that. But we would say you wouldn't treat an intern like that, right? If you had a Harvard MBA intern come in for the summer, you wouldn't give them.
We don't know any Harvard MBAs here in this room at all, do we?
None. That's why I use this. Totally random, right? But if you brought them in for the summer, you don't give them a line of instruction or even a paragraph instruction and then send them off for a few weeks. You're coaching them. You're supervising. You're giving input. Oh. You're giving guidance, right? And but that requires a managerial skill. It requires a human skill. And thinking about AI, I realize that there's dangers to anthropomorphizing AI. Thinking about AI more like another person and less like a technology is very valuable. And if you think about it as a conversational skill that you're actually building over time, that's really critical. We would say that the primary measure most leaders should be paying attention to right now is what percentage of my workforce feels comfortable or confident leveraging this technology. Right now, the predominant sentiment is fear. And what we're hoping to do through our drill coaching and other advising is move people from, and even through the article, right? Move people from fear through familiar and fluent, ultimately to having fun. The kind of the best case users that we are interacting with in the world as they're employing AI in organizations, they report to us that they're regularly giggling at what AI is doing. And we'd say, if you aren't regularly giggling, you aren't nearly fluent enough.
So from fear to fun.
I giggle when I'm with Ray all the time.
And to your point, Vala, sometimes you need that external facilitator who doesn't have a dog in the race to help encourage that giggling to take place and to create that space. And so that was really insightful, is that sometimes you need somebody external to help you do that to get you to that giggling.
And if you're not involving more people into the space, what you're missing is that diversity of thought, right? You're not getting all the other inputs that are there. Oh, Vala, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just at the macro level. If we all, and I don't know if we all agree, but if we all agree that we're on a journey where it's not human-led machine assist, but perhaps in the near future, machine-led human assist, at least in certain functions, so the dominant logic that we have to overcome is trusting, like, will interns and co-ops 10 years from now have a digital manager because their work is tactical in nature. It's not operational or strategic. It's very systematic. It's very deterministic in nature. So why not grade their performance with a very smart assistant? But would you work for a company where your manager at entry level was an algorithm?
I feel, Vala, respectfully, I would say, I'll tell a story and it will hopefully make the point that I'm trying to make. Kian and I, just last week, we're working with a multi-billion dollar company, helping them assess the landscape of possibilities for, call it, AI-powered initiatives, whether it's maybe automating workflows or driving revenue or entering new markets. We were doing a very broad landscape analysis before we then led them through a prioritization activity where we helped them kind of think about making the business case for resourcing experiments, okay? The end point of this particular session was the 10 senior leaders there responsible for major lines of business, their job is to submit a memo to the general manager of this significant business unit over the course of the weekend. So we get everybody to the point that they all know what they want to propose and why, and then we've given them a construct to think about how to propose that. By the way, of course, in collaboration with AI. And at the end of the session, we handed it to the general manager for any closing remarks. And he said what sounded responsibly, he said the following: folks, when you send me your memos, don't worry. I'm not going to let ChatGPT read them. I'm going to be reading them and making decisions. And I said, I'm sorry, hang on one second. And that's similar to what you just said, Paula. And I said, hang on one second. Would you continue to see a radiologist who told you, don't worry, I'm the only person who's going to read your scans. I'm not going to let an AI look at your scans at all. I said, I think you'd run for the hills, right? I think what you meant to say was, of course I'm going to look at the scans. Of course I'm going to read the memos. And in order to check my own human bias and to flag anything I might have missed and to get a broader perspective than the one that I can bring to them, I'm going to leverage every technology available to me to make sure that we're making the right decisions. And I think that we have a fundamental suspicion that, you know, it, going back to the premise of your question, Vala, do you want to work in a company where your manager is an AI? I think right now our fundamental assumption is that's a bad thing. What if, though? I mean, what we know is patient outcomes. Actually, patients prefer AI bedside manner to you know, human doctor bedside manner. What if the world is your AI boss is more compassionate, more empathetic, more understanding, more mindful of your career goals? Like, do you want to work for a better boss? I think is the question, whether they're an AI boss or not. But when you lead with the kind of dystopian sci-fi premise, of course, everybody goes no. But that, to me, it's somewhat akin to a well-intentioned business manager saying, don't worry, I'm not going to let AI read these memos. I go, actually, that's why I'm worried. I want AI to complement.
It's learning from the 360-degree feedback.
Former Clay Christensen, you mentioned Harvard, I think about Innovator's Dilemma and all his amazing work. Mm. Is the job to be done for you and Kian to humanize AI so people are more comfortable, more optimistic, more eager, more competent? Well,
I think what's going to happen in the near future is that technology is going to just become more conversational, like we have conversations right now. And so the interface that people interact right now with AI is going to evolve and get embedded in all kinds of platforms that we already use. And it'll be less techie and more human design oriented.
Sure. According to Naval Ravikant, he says there won't be a UI. Right. AI means no UI. Yeah. You know,
here's the point that I want to pick up on Jeremy's about the AI manager. I actually deeply believe that, yes, AI will automate some tasks. It's going to free up time for us to focus on other things that are really the heart and soul of human relationships at work, like collaboration and creativity and communication. I actually think AI will be managing some tasks in the future, but human managers, if you're not good at those core skills of communication and translation and collaboration, you will not become a manager in the future. That, I think, is a critical shift in how managers are going to evolve in the very near future with AI.
Yeah. Where and when you insert a human is going to be just as important as how you build for machine scale in a human age. So it's going to be pretty crazy.
We could talk to you two for another few hours, including Grant and I'm sure our next guest, Chris. So clearly we need to advise ChatGPT and how we invite big brains to our show.
There you go. He's got it going. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God, that was the fastest 20 minutes I've had all week. Okay, sorry, Ray. Go ahead.
No. Hey, thank you very much. We're here with Jeremy Utley, author of Idea Flow, and Kian Gohar, founder and CEO at Geo Lab. And you can follow him on X at Jeremy Utley and on X at From the KGB. So
please,
thanks a lot for being on the show. Happy Friday.
Thank you.
We will have to lunch soon. So.
Thank you. The research, the Harvard Business Review article, again, long form article, absolutely amazing and counterintuitive, totally counterintuitive. Okay, this is the cleanup hitter spot. For those of you who follow baseball, we bring a big brain and he or she hits a grand slam, and there's no exception here. We are here with Chris Deaver, co-author of Brave Together. All these things we've been talking about, by the way, in terms of co-creation and creativity and machines and humans, we got to do this together. His new book, Brave Together, Lead by Design, Spark Creativity, and Shape the Future with the Power of Co-Creation. And Ray and I are eager to understand the definition of co-creation. Chris is founder of Brave Core, a leadership consultancy that helps leaders be more creative and creatives be better leaders. We need both. Chris has influenced Fortune 500s from the inside, including small companies like, you know, Apple, Disney, creating breakthrough content like Different Together and Collaboration by Design, and inspiring teams shaping iProducts and Star Wars experiences. Chris's clients include, again, Fortune 500 companies, including Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Coca-Cola, LinkedIn, Nike, you know, again, companies we all know. Chris is co-host of a popular podcast, Lead with a Question. He's also co-founded startups and mentored networks with Stephen Covey, the great author of The 8 Habits. Welcome, Chris, to Disrupt TV.
Thank you so much, Vala and Ray. It's great to be here. And, you know, no pressure. I've got, you know, Grand Slam, I guess, on, you know, my mind. And I'm thinking more Kirk Gibson. I mean, I'm just, you know, hobbling to the plate.
Yeah. Oh, that was one of the greatest at-bats of all time. What are you talking about? Wow, sure. That's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, my. Well, yeah, my brother and I had a bet going. He was going for the A's and I was going for the Dodgers. And that was clutch. That was, yeah.
That one. I mean, he's limping to the plate and he hits the winning home run. That's stunning. Stunning. Yeah. I'll never forget that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, thanks for, you know, inviting me. And it's great to be here with you both. And, you know, love the conversation. I'm excited for it. So, yeah.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, hey, I mean, it's an important point. Co-creation. You don't do it on your own. And why is it so hot right now? Why do people need to embrace co-creation?
Well, I think going back to, I mean, just what we were just talking about, you know, people feel like they're kind of hobbling to the plate a bit after COVID, I think, right? There's a lot of dynamics that are happening, big shifts. People are more interested in having a human experience, right, with work. You know, they're facing cultures that they're inviting to their homes, right? In a hybrid world, right? That has shifted their experience. And so I think there's a lot of expectations that have risen about the experience with a manager or a leader. We were just talking about that, the human side of, right, what people expect. And yeah, I think we're seeing just a lot of opportunity to unlock the human potential and turn it into kinetic energy more than we've ever seen before.
You know, so Apple reaches out to you, Apple, you know, comes and says, Chris, come and help tweak, change, optimize our culture. Let us go from think different to different together, given the spirit of co-creation. How do you do this? How do you walk into one of the most successful companies on earth, one of the most valuable companies on earth, one of the most revered companies on earth, and help them tweak their culture so they could co-create even more than in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, the question I got, I was posed by the leadership when I was hired was, hey, we've got 70% of the people that are been here 5 years or less, right, that are new to Apple, and you know, we can't teach them Apple fast enough. You know, Apple's a culture that's definitive, right? Like a Nike or other, it's iconic. And you know, I took that question to mean, how do we take and amplify what's great already, right? Which is think different. We're good at innovation. But the thing that was the challenge was, how does this all come together? And how do we not just work vertically, but work horizontally and connect dots and amplify? And, you know, Apple was doing some of that. We just thought, well, let's heat map this and find those spots that we're doing it in the best way. And one of those was the camera team that does all the camera technologies. right? And they had actually created a camera brain trust in the spirit of what Pixar, you know, had done. And, you know, Ed Catmull in his book, Creativity Inc., he talks about the power of brain trust. And, you know, being at Disney before that, I had the chance to interact some with him and, you know, infuse the Pixar principles into Disney. And these businesses that were pretty static, they would transform and go, you know, 3 or 4x year over year. Wow. Their engagement scores with customers would go up to 60 to 90%. And we just saw power in those principles of brain trust. And so at Apple, it was, well, let's take this that's working great in these camera teams. Let's amplify AirPods, right? Where we're having some friction. There's challenges around how collaboration happens. A lot of people were so siloed, right? Where you get these teams that are interacting in the 11th hour, right? And they're doing 6 hour dailies and people are burned out. And then we're asking the question in postmortems, like, why don't we just back into this? And why aren't you connecting with some regularity? The camera brain trust team, what they would do is they have a standing cross staff meeting, right? Key people from hardware, software, operations, maybe retail would drop in, are coming together, and it's zero ego, building, you know, no ego and building blocks on the table, total transparency around, hey, here's where we're at, here's what we need. And that cross staff would be repeated every week. And so you get that rhythm of consistency and this muscle memory that's just built in where they are fully optimized, right, as a brain trust, and you get, you know, cameras that do what they do. And then AirPods, we infused it with them and, you know, turned into, well, a $24 billion business relatively overnight or seemingly. But I mean, there's a lot of work that went into it. But AirPods Pro, as we iterated, it just got better and better. Then we brought it to iPhone. And, you know, that was an incredible, you know, experience going. You know, iPhone 10 was a big leap at the time, you know, shrinking the antenna and increasing the band, you know, the number of bands that you could do. So it was just amazing to see the cultural spirit of that. You know, Think Different was a very a big stake in the ground about who Apple is fundamentally as their identity. You know, Different Together, and there's a great video Jaws and his team put together in marketing called Join Us Be You, and it's on the Apple site. This was the spirit of Different Together, and it's an ode. It's actually a woman's voice, and it's amazing, like the little animation for this. So you have to check it out. It's like a minute and a half long video. But it's all about, let's bring people in. Let's connect. We can have the full variety of our identity as thinking different and our innovation. And then we can also have the full strength of unity, right? Bringing it all together.
That's amazing. That's it. Chris, you're putting a dent in the universe together. That's awesome. Just listening to you, I'm like, this guy's got the best job. He works with the greatest inventors, greatest companies, and helps them co-create value. That's awesome. It's a dream. It must be. Go ahead, Ray. It must be.
Well, the other piece of that, I mean, you did that in the middle of a culture that has been traditionally very siloed, right? And I think that's to me very, very powerful, because Apple is known
for secret projects, right? Yeah. Is it the secrecy of projects that gives birth to silo culture? I mean, I'm just trying to.
Yeah. Well, yes, and you have generationally, right? Y, Z, Alpha coming in, and they're saying, sure, we don't operate this way, right? Yeah, and by the way, the standing folks that had been there a while, they already had pre-existing connections, right? But the company had grown 10x. So you have all of these teams of hundreds of people that don't know somebody on the other side. And they're saying, I don't even know how to operate in a world where I don't want to end up, you know, fired or in jail in 3 or 4 months for saying something technically that I wasn't supposed to say. And so that was part of the program, part of that initiative, part of that work was to say, let's build some language around this, right?
You guys culture that never was flattened like that before. And that's very, very powerful. My question to you is, like, you've coached people like Tim Cook, you've coached people like Michael Dell. Those are very different organizations. So how does having a co-creative culture and collaboration culture work in those types of organizations? Let's take Dell, for example, which is a very, very different company culturally than Apple.
Yeah, and they've evolved too. I mean, to be fair, but when I look back, when I got there, it was like the sky was falling. There was, layoffs every 6 months. The three VPs that hired me were gone in 3 months, right? Yep, it was that crazy. And Michael had come back as CEO. I'm sitting in a meeting among OD strategists, and we're looking holistically at the organization. And they're mapping out all the strengths and weaknesses, opportunities for Michael. And I'm like, wow, can you even talk this way? But it was exciting because the challenge on the table was, how do we take this to the next level? How do we rethink? And we looked at engagement scores at the time. And oddly enough, this is across all employee, you know, high potential, key talent, top execs. And it was a flipped engagement from what you would expect. At the highest level, they were the least engaged. And so, you know, the PC business had deteriorated. That explained some of it. But we looked at this question of like, what is the problem here? But I'd find myself in meetings looking at, you know, folks are staring at P&L sheets all day long. And I'm saying, this is not innovation. This is not how you do it. And I may be exaggerating, but the feeling was, we need to get to a place where we're innovating and connecting dots. And it's not just answer first. It's listen first. It's not just execute. It's also empower innovation. And I wrote, so we're in a big all hands meeting, and this is actually how this started. And Michael is saying, he's a direct guy, right? Direct model, which we found was a cultural model too. And we realized, well, we got to take that to the next level. He said in all hands, he said, hey, if you got any ideas, we got to transform as a company. So let me know. And I got a team together organically. We wrote a white paper. I wrote a white paper that defined basically, here's all the problems of the company, right? As far as culturally speaking. And there are things that we just talked about. And, you know, Connect model was good for its time, but everybody's caught up, right? These businesses, you know, Apple, HP, they know how to do this. And as a cultural model, being direct all the time, it didn't solve for how to connect, right, holistically and build an ecosystem. Yeah. Yeah. And that collaboration we talk about, co-creation. So we called it the Connect model. And the idea was, let's build these connections. Let's get ideation going, right? Innovation think tanks. And I sent this white paper to Michael. You know, it was a potentially career limiting moment. So my HR chain, you know, calls me in and they're like, what was this email to Michael? And I was like, well, he asked, you know, for ideas in all hands. And they're like, she's like, my manager, like, he didn't, you know, sometimes they say that. I said, well, we're a direct company, right? We believe in integrity. It's like, okay, well, Bob's aware. Bob was like the head of HR. I'm like, okay, so we'll see what happens. The next morning at 5 a.m., Michael sends an email back and he says, huge respect for this initiative, Chris. What are the next steps?
Wow.
I didn't know what the next steps were at the time, but I knew this is where we need to go. I outlined, there was like seven kind of co-creative things we could do. And one of those included innovation and sparking, you know, new thinking in the organization. So we started something called Game Changers. And it was based on this kind of Gen X platform of bringing together people from all these different cross-functionally to spark new ideas.
And I can only imagine Bob Johnson's face at the time when he said that.
Yeah. Well, you know, okay, yeah, it's Bob Johnson. Yeah, okay, I was going to say his last name, but hey, you know, Bob's a tough guy. He was a G.
He's a tough guy.
Yeah, he's one that I can sit in a room. I'm like, man, is this guy going to cut this table right in his half? And half
yeah, hands? That's what I'm like, that's ballsy.
Yeah, so I went for it. And, you know, we landed. We come together and I end up in a meeting with Michael and I'm like, hey, can we get $5 million to get this Game Changer thing going? Yeah, this is awesome, right? And pretty soon we have people coming together from all these different functions that have never been asked, right? There was never an open invitation about, hey, bring your new innovation. And we had a mobile app that emerged from that. It was $1 billion app, right? Wow. That somebody had just been sitting awesome. On the idea awesome. For years.
That's amazing. That's
well, no one have so, ever been so, asked to do that. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. So, Chris, you're speaking to us about the importance of having courage, the importance of integrity, the importance of having a safe space, so you feel that you have the opportunity to share and connect and collaborate. So clearly, brave, the first word in your book, speaks to the important ingredient that we all need to have more of in order to reach our full potential. My question to you, my last question to you, is there any, other than reading your beautiful book, is there a first step? Is there something that, you know, we can do in order to begin this journey of being brave together?
Yeah, I think there's some practical things. One simply is, and we have a podcast called Lead with a Question. This was something we inherited from Ed Catmull, who started Pixar, and he spent the most time with Steve Jobs, working with him 26 years. And we were sitting in a meeting with him and I thought he's Yoda, right? We're going to click the wisdom dispenser, and this guy's going to just, he's going to dump into our fertile minds, right? And we're going to start to become Padawan Jedis like we need to be. And we're sitting there, and actually, he's just listening and asking powerful questions. This goes on for like 20, 30 minutes. I thought we just had 30 minutes with him. It turned into 3 hours. And at one point, I stopped and I said, Ed, what's your leadership philosophy? And, you know, I've read Creativity, Inc., the book. He covers a lot of the bases of this. But he said in simply one statement, he said, I lead with a question.
Yes.
Wow.
And there's so much power in that, in leadership, especially today. And we talk about the future, right? We zoom out. We talk about this in the book. There have been waves of a focus on efficiency. There have been waves of focus on effectiveness, which, you know, some people are still optimizing that world of hacks, hustle, and leaders are trying to optimize performance. And guess what? It does not speak to the hearts. It doesn't make anybody's heart sing, right? You show up on the street, you're like, hey, you know, we're focused on a vision, execution. And people are like, really? I don't want any part of that.
Barf,
you know?
No.
But the tidal wave that's happening, and with AI too, like the conversation you're just having, the biggest tidal wave is co-creation. And it is what you name the generation, including us, you know, from their incumbents. We all want this. Like, we want our hearts to be able to sing in the work we do. And co-creation is the path to actually doing this.
Is it because it's ultimately about shared success? Like, when you co-create and that billion-dollar app makes it to market, you got a lot of people that are happy and proud and sense of belonging and mattering. And so just the fact that it's not just you, it's you and someone else or a team of people working to achieve shared success, I think that's awesome.
You nailed it. Yeah. And we've been so, and especially in the Western world, so obsessed with this idea of self-made success. And that's a stepping stone, right? We got to be brave rather than have fear. That's good. But being brave together and sharing that success. I mean, think about it this way too. We as human beings love the sense of flow, right? When we can step outside of time, right?
Love flow.
Yeah. I'm sure we all have something we love, right? Like you love sport, right? So basketball, you still play occasionally. You get in that flow and you're like,
total.
Oh my gosh. Like, and you know, an hour could fly by and you're like, that felt like a minute. Like that was amazing.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And then what happens when it's shared flow? Right. When you have a team like the Warriors.
It's a shared flow right here.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is.
This past hour, I've been in a flow state because as our guests are talking, I'm like, we could be talking to Chris for another hour.
Right.
Like, it's been the fastest hour of my week because smart people like you pull us into your flow of knowledge and dump these golden nuggets of wisdom on us. And, you know, and Ray and I, we take pride in.
We have front row seat.
And asking a lot of guys, I'm taking a lot of your time with my commentary. But anyway, I love flow. Well,
it's
love
the best feeling. It's like the best feeling in the world, right? And then with people you love. And then the question is this, it's quite simply this. When was the last time, and we could ask ourselves, that you felt that it work, right? In a meeting, in a conversation. Yeah. And why? And here's a what if. What if you could feel that every time you're in a meeting? Every time you're working with your team, I'll tell you what, we did this with a session with a tech company out here, and they're like, you know, planning an 8-hour Zoom meeting. You can imagine, right? This is like offsite, but on virtual. And I'll tell you what, we did 3 activities that were all about shared flow. By the end of the 8 hours, people were so amped, and it was all just pure energy. It was like perpetual motion. They're like, can we stay on? This is amazing. Right. And how is that possible? 8 hours of Zoom? Right.
But eight that's hours of Zoom. Wow.
You have a superpower, man. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Well, everybody has it. Everybody has this, right? We talk about safe space is good. And we wrote a big think article about this, about brave space is how do we create this space where we're sharing at that level and we're stepping outside of time. And that's what co-creation is. And the thing is all the best brands, all the best companies we know of have been doing this for years, right? For decades even. And they're at the top, right? You talk about Apple, Microsoft, you know, now NVIDIA, like they have the building blocks of culture, of shared wisdom, deep empathy. They're powered by principles and they're co-creating all the time.
This has been wonderful. Amazing. Everyone should check out the book. Amazing. Brave Together came out December 5th. It's going to be a perennial favorite. Check it out. Lead by design, start creativity, and shape the future with the power of co-creation. Chris, thanks for being on the show, and happy Friday.
Grand slam, Chris. That was
thanks
awesome.
Thanks so much, Paul. Yeah, thank you, Ray.
See you in the green room.
Thank you. Thanks. Or I'll hobble back off.
That was awesome. That's like Ortiz, bottom of the 13th, beating the Yankees to come back from an 0-3 deficit to win the World Series. That was that performance. Big Pappy Chris is what I'm going to call him from now on.
Big Pappy Ray, Chris.
You know, the funny thing is, and Chris reminds us, flow is all around us. We just come up with creative ways of disrupting it. And it's amazing to have an incredible CEO like Grant and two incredible CEOs and academic all-stars reminding us that humanizing technology is really important in order for us to get rid of our dominant logic and really use the tools we need to be successful. Ray, come on, close it for us. What's the big takeaway for you?
You too can be Chris Evans. No, just kidding. I mean, look, we're entering a new age, and this is the important piece. We're in the age of AI. We're going to have to learn how to work differently. We're going to learn how to actually build different types of business models. We're going to have to lead differently. We're going to have to co-create differently. And more importantly, we're going to have to figure out how we actually work with each other to actually create those new types of ideas. I think the important piece is we're operating at machine scale, and we actually have to, you know, think about humanity operating in machine scale. How do you actually humanize that AI piece? But I think the most important thing here is actually companies that are actually using AI have to look at it this way. When refrigerators were being invented, people thought refrigerator companies were going to lead, they're going to kick butt, these are the place to go. It's the companies that actually built business models around refrigeration that kicked butt and took everything. And that was Coca-Cola and that was Pepsi. They did so much better than those other companies. The next set of companies are going to co-create and build on AI business models that are going to actually operate differently, look differently, think differently, and actually, you know, perform much more exponentially differently than everyone else. And that's where we're headed. And I think these tools here today and these conversations can help people get there.
Beautiful summary. Thank you to our guests who expanded our minds. And next week, we have Jeremy Kubicek, co-author of Communication Code, Unlock Every Relationship, One Conversation at a Time. We had a guest cancel next week, so if you want to recommend to Ray and I this weekend who you'd like for us to bring,
we can be fast.
But we need it by Monday.
So we need it by Monday. It was a legendary guest.
Yeah, so send your recommendations, and we'll do our best to get whomever you recommend, whoever gets the most, you know, likes, if you're sharing on LinkedIn or X, and we'll do our best to get them on the show. Yes. If it's Friday, it's Disrupt TV. We'll see you next week, episode 358. Thank you, everyone. Cheers.